What an absolute honor to fill in for Rush Limbaugh on the EIB network. The phone number is 800-282-2882. And so fascinating in the wake of the horrendous attacks in and around New York City. So fascinating to watch the left and the media and activists struggle with how they treat Jewish people in terms of the great intersectional, you know, massing of people together that the left chooses to say are perpetual victims. It's funny. I don't know any Jewish person who views himself in a state of perpetual victimhood. I don't know very many people who view themselves in that way. But it's so instructive to view what goes on in the minds of the left and in the hive mind, or what I would say the Borg collective of the left, that is the media, that is academia, that is the activists. Bret Stephens used to be a conservative, writes at the New York Times now. Bret Stephens stepped way, way, way outside of the realm of the Overton window of acceptability when Bret Stephens wrote a piece in the New York Times wherein he praised the culture of Jewish people for helping to create a group of folks who are very well educated and very smart. And what he wrote about was a religious tradition, he said, that, unlike some others, asked the believers not only to observe and obey, but to discuss and disagree. He wrote, there is the never quite comfortable status of Jews in places where they are the minority, intimately familiar with the customs of the country while maintaining a critical distance from them. This is a moral belief incarnate in the Jewish people, according to Einstein, that the life of the individual only has value insofar as it adds to the making of the life of every living thing nobler and more beautiful. So he wrote this piece in praise of a cultural phenomenon that has helped Jewish people, in his eyes, be more successful, smarter, and more learned. Then he mentions IQ. That's it. So Bret Stephens now encounters cultural, or the cancel culture. The New York Times removed from his piece mention of IQ because, of course, IQ is racist and the people who thought it up are terrible people, etc. ad nauseum. Instead of writing a counter editorial, they removed this. So step number one, don't you dare praise Jewish culture. Don't do that. Don't point to that having improved people's minds. Do not make a praiseworthy statement. See how the left struggles with this, right? Because they should be able to say it's a beautiful culture, right? Because, of course, there is the intersection out of it. They struggle with Jewish people. They don't know how to treat Jewish people, even in the light of these horrendous attacks. So step number two in examining this. Don't you dare say that black people can have hatred in their hearts, or that there can be black nationalism. Because in the wake of these attacks in and around New York City, CBS and NBC, this is from Newsbusters, decided that it was immaterial to mention the Hanukkah attackers' connection to a radical group called the Black Hebrew Israelites, who are, in fact, well, they're out West Coast as well, but I think they're much more dominant in the East Coast. They're the people who went and basically threatened, or at least harassed, the Covington, Kentucky high school students in Washington, D.C. You remember this, Nicholas Sandman. They were harassing them, yelling racially, you know, terrible things at the kids and bigoted things at the kids. And CNN invested a week telling us that, no, they're a peaceful group. They were the victims. And they were clearly afraid of this gaggle of largely white kids from Kentucky. And one of them was wearing a Trump hat. So CBS and NBC entirely skipped the connection to the Black Hebrew Israelites, or at least the fascination with that the attacker had, who went into the rabbi's home and used a machete to attack people. So that's immaterial. So one hand, don't praise Jewish culture for producing successful people. On the other hand, don't you dare point to a group that's problematic that happens to be peopled by African Americans. Now, I'm at a loss, entirely at a loss, as to how it helps African American people to not point out that there's a dangerous group called the Black Hebrew Israelites. I don't understand how that serves anybody in the black community to ignore that group or to soft pedal that group. Now we get, though, to classic New York Times. New York Times wrote in very New York Times style a piece about this attacker, the suspect in Monday's stabbings, a search online for Hitler. So they talk about the attacker. They call him, of course, Mr. Thomas, because it's the New York Times. It is probably a, I got tired of counting, but it's probably a 35 to 40 paragraph story. Down near the probably last four paragraphs, they get to mentioning the fact that this attacker also was fascinated with the Black Hebrew Israelites. Now, I ask you this. He says, oh, he heard voices. He probably is mentally ill. We know about his criminal history. We'll get to that in a second. But New York Times buries this in the bottom of the piece. People like this attacker, they are particularly susceptible to the sort of suggestions that come out from the Black Hebrew Israelites. They, mentally ill people, are particularly susceptible to that form of extremism. If we were concerned about this, if the media was concerned about this, they might dig in a little bit to what the Black Hebrew Israelites are doing. Here's the classic part about the Times piece. They say that they're not yet certain that there is a tie between him and this group and the attack in New Jersey where a police officer was killed and then that assailant went and attacked people in a Jewish deli. There is at least this connection in that attacker was connected to the group. This attacker was fascinated with the group, but they find it more interesting that he searched for Hitler than they find it interesting that he was fascinated with a group that operates today in New York City and around the country today. So they're not fascinated with that at all. But it goes on. A New York Times journalist said, don't look at the Black Hebrew Israelites. Don't look at that. Don't look at the success of Jewish culture, as Brett Stevens is now facing cancel culture for even pointing out the success of Jewish culture. Don't do that. Look at conservative bloggers. It's conservative bloggers who, in fact, caused this guy to go out and stab Hasidic Jews. So conservative bloggers who are almost uniformly in favor of Israel, almost uniformly defenders of Israel, they're the ones to blame in this guy's eyes. Now, this stuff is so endemic. I want to get to that in a second. On the left, Powerline blog points out the criminal history of this attacker, Thomas. He has been on the police's radar forever. He has been in, since 2001, he had offenses that included assault, resisting arrest, killing or injuring a police animal, driving under the influence, possessing controlled substances, menacing a police officer, and he appears to receive a jail sentence only for a 2013 arrest for possession of a controlled substance. So again, intersectionality. Again, the left's war on standards. So Brett Stevens speaks of a standard of the IQ test, speaks of a successful culture that has created a culture of people who are very well educated, great at debate, great at discussion. Brett Stevens is in trouble. Most of the media is saying, don't look at the Black Hebrew Israelites. Don't you dare, because they're black. We can't have you talk about black nationalism. That's not helping anybody. That's an intersectional unit. We can't have you attacking that. You have this journalist for New York Times saying, oh, okay, well, no, it's the conservative bloggers. Then to top this all off, you have this guy's criminal history. And you have probably this condition of mental illness. And that is endemically ignored by the left, because we can't go around putting people in jail. You can't go out and criminalize things like this. Who are you going to help by putting a guy in jail if he's mentally ill? Okay, I concur. Mentally ill people should be sometimes, often, particularly in cases like this, forced into treatment, forced into a place where they can receive medicine and help, etc. But you're not. It's not about when you're jailing them. It's not about helping them. It's about getting them out of the way so they don't harm others. But that violates a tenet of leftism. How endemic is this? There was a guy in Seattle named Ari Hoffman who ran for city council. He did this because he faced utter frustration. because he worked at and is on the board of a Jewish cemetery out here where homeless addicts were allowed, literally allowed, to sleep on his property, to defecate on his property, to leave spent needles on his property, where kids would go out and possibly be stabbed by these needles. He asked the city, you got to help. Ari Hoffman said, you got to help me. You got to help clean this up. The city refused. So he decided to run for office. Now, this is in liberal Seattle. Decided to run for office. One of the first things that happened is they put a photo of his child on 8chan with the word kike-et to describe Ari's child. They began stalking him. They began suggesting that they should go by his house and protest him and dox him. And my understanding is the FBI is involved in this. So once again, as we talked about last hour, repressive tolerance. No tolerance for Ari because he wanted the laws followed. And you go right back up the chain to Brett Stevens. Don't you dare praise Jewish culture. Can you see the confusion this is creating in the left in terms of their intersectionality? It's Todd Herman filling in for Rush Limbaugh on the EIB Network. It's Todd Herman filling in for Rush Limbaugh on the EIB Network. Coming up on the program, just, I think, a fascinating comparison. In California, the soft bigotry of low expectation versus Harvard's hard bigotry of obvious exclusionary tactics. Just a little bit of a look back on the year, and I look forward to the year. This is the last show, Rush Limbaugh show, for 2019. Kirk from Lake Ozarks, Missouri, you are on the Rush Limbaugh program. Todd Herman filling in. Hi, Kirk.
Hi, how are you doing? Just noted yesterday at the top of the hour on the CBS News, and they reported on the Muslim stabbing at the mosque in New York City, and they went on and on about how it was domestic terrorism and there's systemic anti-Semitism across the United States and all this. And then they report on the shooting at the Christian church out in Texas, and there's no statistics about attacks on Christianity or Christians or any of the talk or any domestic terrorism against Christians, any of that kind of talk. So why is the media just so hell-bent on saying that America is anti-Semitic, but yet there's no talk of why there's attacks on Christian churches? Because, you know, it's not the first Christian church shooting by any means, and it's not the only attack on Christians in across America. But the last one I can think of is the five black people that were shot. So they labeled that as racist, but not anti-Christianity.
Yeah, I am tempted to say something here, and this is Rush's show, so I want to be super careful. But I'll say something that okay, so this is in my heart. It's on my heart, Kirk. I truly believe that there are people in national media who sort of have a kind of quiet feeling that what they perceive as the dominant culture doesn't deserve defending. I'm not saying that they want to see, you know, Christians killed. I don't know that to be the case. I doubt it is. But I sort of feel like they are kind of, they have this mindset that we shouldn't really defend this. We shouldn't really help because there's sort of a comeuppance needed. And if you think about the media's love affair with the notion of reparations, which is where you take money from people who never held slaves to give money to people who were not slaves themselves and sometimes often didn't come from a history of slavery. You can look at the sort of their affection for that idea. You get sort of this idea or their easy acceptance of the new original sin of whiteness, where the media uncritically will have specials and town halls about whiteness, which is really, they speak of institutional racism against African-Americans, and certainly there are racists in our society. It's a human failing. It's never going to go away. But they will then uncritically have people speak of the condition of whiteness, which is to say that you carry with you this original sin because of your, you know, so-called race, which is really what they mean, melanin levels at that point, because they're not even really talking about a race. So I think that may play into this. I hope that doesn't sound unduly cynical to you, Kirk.
No, like I said, I just didn't know if I'm the only one that noticed it, because like I said, there seems to be plenty of statistics and eagerness to say how terrible anti-Semitic the country is, when actually most of it seems to be in New York City, but... You know, I just, I don't, I just don't understand where that spin comes from and why there's such a difference between attacks on Christianity versus attacks on Judaism.
Well, I've given one shot in on that. I think that's a reason why is I think that really is in their hearts. And Kirk, I appreciate the phone call. Thanks for calling the Rush Limbaugh program. Bob in Peoria, Illinois, you're on the Rush Limbaugh program. Todd Herman filling in. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Todd. How are you?
Doing great.
My question is that the founding of our country was done at the point of a gun. We've survived a civil war that was at the point of a gun. We've survived world wars that were at the point of a gun, but is our republic more in danger at the point of a pen that could sign legislation or just not even enforce legislation, like, say, the border and immigration laws? Is that more of a threat to our republic and our democracy than the point of a gun? We've been able to survive.
Yeah, Bob, that's a great question. Thank you for the call. That is a great question, and I love the way that you phrased that. Let me give you this example. What does the word "and" mean to you? Does the word "and" mean? Is there a very clear meaning to that word, right? "And"? Our alleged attorney general in our state, leftist state, who spends his time suing Trump, we call him Sideshow Bob, he pretended that the word "and" means "or." Okay, and he did that to preserve a law that is going to hit your state, that you're going to leave your garage in the morning in your car, and a computer's going to decide what you pay to drive to work. It might be $5, it might be $50. And if you can't afford $50, that's okay, because that puts you onto a train or onto a bus, which is the ultimate goal. To preserve this tolling scheme that was illegal because it didn't meet the two objectives it had to meet. One was an average speed in the lane. The other was an average revenue projection. They got the revenues. They didn't get the speed. They had to do one thing and the other. So this very dangerous so-called attorney general in our state said "and" means "or." So by way of answering your question, are we more at risk at the tip of a pen versus the tip of a gun? I'd say it's more likely that we are at risk by the tip of a gun. Pardon me, at the tip of a pen. I'd say it's far more likely that we're at risk at the tip of a pen because it's being done all around us, right? That laws are being written all around us to curtail liberties or to refuse to follow liberties. You will in your lifetime, if government health care is taken over, if Medicaid for all is a fait accompli, you will be told what to eat. You will be told what to eat and in what amounts. You face a future that now corporatists, and when I say corporatists, I mean entities who exist to lobby to have business by force to get monopolies, government-sponsored monopolies. They're working with cities to meter your washing of your clothes and dishes to make sure you do it at the time they want you to do it, lest you pay quadruple the rate. So right now, we're far more at risk at the tip of the pen, and 2020 is upon us, and the president is tied for popularity with Barack Obama. Despite these years of trying to ruin his reputation, we are winning, Bob. You are winning. You're part of that, so continue to win. It's Todd Herman in for Rush Limbaugh on the EIB Network. So it's an amazing honor to fill in for Rush. It's Todd Herman. Thank you for putting up with just a tiny little guest host in the presence of a giant, or in the microphone of a giant. Joe Biden says Joe Biden says that, I'd run with a Republican as vice president. Sure I would. I can't think of one right now, but I certainly would. Can you think of any Republican who would stand to run with Joe Biden? Now, think hard about this, because Biden was asked this question that someone said, my kid was suggesting, hey, I wonder if Joe Biden would ever run with a Republican for vice president. And Joe Biden said, of course I would. I can't think of any right now. He wanted to say there's some decent Republicans, but of course he's doing the thing where they need to step up. Because you remember the way the Democrats stepped up with Barack Obama, when there was the illegal payment to Iran. Remember all the Democrats who stood up and said, that's illegal. That's a ransom payment. You did that in the dead of night in pallets of foreign cash. You can't do that. When Barack Obama autocratically edited a law, so-called, passed by Congress 17 times with Obamacare. You remember, of course, all the Democrats standing up and saying, my gosh, you can't do that. You don't have a line item veto. You don't get to do that. Of course, that didn't happen. So Joe Biden is suggesting that there's someone out there who would fit that bill. I want to just throw something out this way for you to think about. Can you imagine? Now, just picture the scene that Joe Biden puts a call in to Mitt Romney. So Mitt Romney, just picture the meeting. Just picture the dinner between the two guys. And you might start to get a sense of a future that could occur, but would be completely dependent upon Mitt Romney's ego versus Mitt Romney's knowledge of the left. So what would be the process of persuading Romney to do that? Would Biden play on Romney's ego? Would Biden say, I'm in my 70s, I'm not likely to live very long, you might be able to serve a term? Would he lurch that way, or would he try to seduce him based upon, Mitt, this is your opportunity to be, in fact, the bridge builder that you fancy yourself. This is your, what would be the tactic they would use to bring Romney over to that? Because I am of the firm opinion Romney would listen to that. It's my contention that Romney is blithely unaware of the true mechanisms at play in the left. Now, if that sounds weird, that, wait a minute, you know, Herman, he's been in politics for all this time. You're telling me he doesn't know how the left works. I am telling you that I have sat with the best of the best and the brightest in Washington, D.C., and brought up things like a picture of Che Guevara. I was doing a presentation to a group of the best, the chiefs of staff, the digital heads, the big wigs of congressional and senatorial offices. I think mostly congressional offices. One of my slides had a picture of Che Guevara on it. Che Guevara t-shirt. And a guy in the back raised his hand and said, yeah, I got a question. Who's the Mexican guy in the t-shirt? I said, seriously? He goes, yeah, I don't know who that is. I said, okay, his name's Che Guevara. This guy said to me, well, the good news is, if I don't know, then none of the kids voting Democrat know. That was in 2008. They didn't know this. They didn't recognize that iconic picture. So Mitt runs in circles where he is unaffected by the true mechanisms of the left. So he pals around and thinks, oh, Biden's missed, you know, this great guy. This is a possibility. And if Biden did that, yes, it would be an act of desperation. Yes, his party would throw him overboard. Yes, the DNC would revolt. But I could definitely see the conversations going on. Sylvia in Parrish, Florida, you are on the Rush Limbaugh program. Todd Herman filling in. Hello, Sylvia.
Hi. I have a question for you. I don't know if you know the answer, but I'm curious. Nobody seems to know how long Pelosi can hold on to these articles of impeachment. So is it possible that she can hold on to them through the 2020 elections should the Democrats regain majority in the Senate so that when she sends them over at that point, she's assured a conviction?
I have talked to a couple of different constitutional scholars, and I should at least say constitutional professors or professors of constitutional law on this, and they're of the opinion that that's not called out, that the founders did not ever think of a woman like Nancy Pelosi who would do that. There was such thought put into the impeachment process and such exacting language, and they wanted to make it so hard and so difficult. They wanted to make it so precise that they had long debates about how to do this because it's such a serious topic. Would Pelosi do this? Yes. Could she do this? Yes. Would it end up in the courts? I think it would obviously end up in the courts. But can you imagine the damage she would do if she actually held these articles and if, God forbid, the Democrats took the Senate and President Trump was, in fact, convicted? Can you imagine the damage she would do to this country? Inexorable. It could never be recovered. Nancy Pelosi is a person who would do that, and I believe that with my full heart. So can she? Yes. How would that end in the courts? Don't know. But what would they do? Tell the president to leave? Right? It would be completely debatable at that point. That is a horrific thing, but I'm glad you brought it up, Sylvie. Thanks very much for the phone call. It's a horrific thing to imagine, right? Because this is an eventuality that Nancy Pelosi would pursue. When you take a person, Pelosi, who is very famous for having a tactic during the Obamacare debates, do you remember the deemed to have passed? Do you remember that? where she and a woman named Louise Slaughter were willing to not vote on Obamacare, to literally not have a vote, but to deem it to have passed as if it actually passed the House of Representatives, to save their members from soft districts from having to take a vote. They were willing to say it passed without a vote, which, again, imagine the permanent damage this would do. So speaking of the Democrats, Tulsi Gabbard has now criticized her own party for being willing to keep what she says, keep kids, this is her quote, rotting in prison instead of giving Trump a win. Something's going on with Tulsi Gabbard. Have you noticed this with her? That A, she voted present for impeachment, so she didn't vote for moving forward. B, she is pointing out that the Democrats could have changed the law that forced the president's hand to keep the families separated. The same thing Barack Obama did. That's where the pictures, the media merchandise came from. She's calling out her own party on this. Is she auditioning for a party flip? I don't know if we'd want her because she's actually a pretty hardcore leftist. But is she auditioning for that? Is she auditioning for a Fox News role? Something's going on with her because she knows she's not going to be president of the United States. She's a secret Russian. Yes, okay. Tulsi Gabbard, that's right. That's it. She's a secret Russian. Nancy Pelosi and others have figured that out. Tom from Salt Lake City, Utah. You are on the Rush Limbaugh program. Todd Herman filling in. One of my former homes, Tom, Salt Lake City. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Hey, listen, I'd like to talk today about turning a Trump event into a Trump-a-thon where we can actually raise money during the event. So you start 6 or 7 hours before the event. You have all the commentary in the world, all the naysayers. You show this, all the things they've said negative about the president. The president comes on. He makes his presentation 6 or 7 hours afterwards. And all during this time, we're allowing people to donate money to the cause. And the cause is to make sure we can get a person running in every district in the country, every Senate seat, every rep seat, be able to fund it, have money to back them, to plaster the place with the billboards, the airwaves, whatever it takes, because we're going to need every Senate seat, every House seat in order to keep this thing going on. But it can be done with a Trump live event. You can raise money, enormous amounts of money. Listen, people donated $60, I think was the average donation for Trump the last election. I guarantee you, if this thing was live, where people could participate live, actually talking to hosts before who are showing these events that as they've happened with the crazy media, with the crazy Democrats, et cetera, the rhinos, whatever. But people can donate while this is going on, and I hear he would raise an enormous amount of money.
I hear exactly what you're saying. A Trump-a-thon would be huge. You could have pay-per-view. You could have levels. You buy in. You see the whole thing. For a little extra money, you can be in the commentariat. For a whole lot of money, maybe you get a chance to ask the president a question. I love it, Tom. You should organize this. Maybe you can help make money off of it. Take a percentage rake. That's the way the game is played in politics. Tom, thank you for the phone call. Brilliant idea. It's Todd Herman filling in for Rush Limbaugh on the EIB Network. All right, coming up on the Rush Limbaugh program, Todd Herman filling in. Take a little bit of a look back at the year. This is something recent Rush said to young people on how to be success. I want to give you a chance to have young people tune in. We're going to do it next segment. It's a life lesson that I know has hit me incredibly hard in a really positive way when I was a kid. And I've heard Rush say things like this from time to time. We're going to get into that next segment. If you got young people and they love Rush and they want to know how to be successful, that's going to come up because we're taking a look back at the year as well. Let's go to John in Cleveland, Ohio. John, you're on the Rush Limbaugh program. Todd Herman filling in. Hi, John.
Hi. I think there's some stereotyping going on many of these programs, talk show programs across the country to misrepresent the left, misrepresent what they really call for, almost cartoonishly, because I've checked some, I don't belong to any organization myself, but I've checked some left-wing sites like Global Research, Information Clearinghouse, and others, and they are absolutely excoriating the Democrats and this cabal of the FBI, the CIA, the corporate media, and the military-industrial complex in their attempt to overthrow Trump, and they for the wrong reasons. The Republicans and the Democrats are both committed to glorifying those criminal organizations of the FBI frame-up artists, the CIA Murder Incorporated, and its depredations around the world. It's attacks on honest dissidents in the United States through its sabotage programs against honest dissidents in the 60s, the COINTELPRO program, the Operation Chaos of the CIA. And I think that the leftists actually are on the side of defending Trump while at the same time opposing many of his policies, because they excoriate this cabal of secret police, military-industrialist interlock with the media to get rid of Trump because he's an inconsistent warmonger and servant of those really imperial interventions around the world. He seems to be trying to appease his attackers by giving them much of the warmongering they want, but they want a consistent 100% warmonger like Hillary Clinton.
So let me ask you a question. I'm just confusing something. So when the president kept his promise to pull troops out of the Middle East, how was that then giving them what they want?
Well, that was something that could be applauded, but he's moved them to Iraq, and he's moved them to a different part of Syria. That is a very good thing. But whenever he does that, he brings down the entire infrastructure of the military-industrial secret police complex and the media upon him. And I think he's too much in a mode of trying to appease them. And
when they had demanded further incursion in the Middle East and demanded more of that, and Trump said no, how did that give them what they wanted?
Well, he hasn't actually pulled them out, and now he is accentuating all of the incitement and conflict with Iran and really in close coordination with the Zionist lobby and Jared Kushner and the rest of it, and giving the Israelis, which are part of probably the most rabid section of the military U.S. military-industrial complex, what they want. In a war with Iran, so I see.
I'm just trying to understand something. So by pulling the troops out and not putting them in, not further incurring, committing to further incursions, he's giving them what they want. I'm getting a little lost, John. It might be the connection, etc. But that's a mouthful. I'll think about that. Thank you for the phone call, I'll think a lot about that. But I got a little bit lost in that. Maybe it's a connection, John. Jeremy in Bretton, Florida. You're on the Rush Limbaugh program. Todd Herman filling in.
Yes, one moment. I'm on speakerphone. You want to be? There we go. All right. Yes, I was calling in reference to. I'm an atheist conservative, and I'm just kind of out there wondering why some of you conservative talk show hosts don't kind of try to lean towards some of the atheists. I feel like there's a large group of atheists out there that would go along with with the Republican backing or conservative backing if they actually didn't feel like it was religious in nature.
So I want to make sure that I understand this. So you, Jeremy, are on the phone on the world's largest radio show, accepted, welcomed, screened, here to make your points, and we're not accepting you?
Well, I don't think that you're not so much accepting me as that I feel like you lean more into religion than the actual politics of the situation, and I feel like it might open up more doors to listeners or people who would understand or believe what you're having to say if it wasn't so tied into religion.
I see. So we talked earlier in the program. I talked about redemption and a perfect vessel. That was in the first hour of the program. Since then, we've talked a lot of policy. We've talked about Joe Biden. We did talk about anti-Semitism. I mean this in complete and utter respect for you. Would you have me hide my belief in the Lord any more than you would ever hide your lack of belief or your belief in something?
No.
Else? Yeah.
No, by all means. I'm not like an angry atheist. I believe religion serves a purpose, and I think everybody has.
Yeah.
You know, some people need religion in order to be good people.
And some people truly believe that there is, it's an impossibility that everything came from nothing. I'd love to have a scientific conversation with you sometime. Listen, you're welcomed, Jeremy. I'm, you know, it's not my show. It's Rush's show. But I want you to know you're welcomed. We appreciate you. And really, thank you for making the phone call. Thank you. And yes, you're part of the team, Jeremy. Stay on the team. It's Todd Herman filling in for Rush Limbaugh on the EIB Network. Todd Herman filling in for Rush Limbaugh on the EIB Network. Next hour, Glenn Greenwald, not conservative by any stretch of imagination, did an incredible list of the things the media got wrong, just flat out false in the Russia hoax story. On RushLimbaugh.com, there is a great piece of audio if you are a 24/7 member. Where Rush gives advice to young people on how to be successful. Rush changed my life. And it's not like I was hanging out with him. I heard him on the radio. And he has some consistent pieces of advice. Number one is never listen to people who failed at what you want to do because they're going to be bitter. They're going to convince themselves that it can't be done because they couldn't do it. Talk to people who've done it. When you talk to people who've done it, ask a lot of questions. Dig in, ask them how they did it. Doesn't mean you need to do it that way, but dig into how they did it. But don't think you can succeed by asking questions. This is my saying that there's a myth that information is power. It's not. It's potential power. It only becomes power when you use it. And most importantly, Rush points to the fact that in his observation, successful people love what they do. They choose to do what they love. So many people only love their hobbies, but you live in a country where your hobby can become your living. I am living proof of the fact that the thing you love can be the thing you do for a living. It's Todd Herman in for Rush Limbaugh on the EIB Network.